So as we work our way through the pastoral letters or epistles to Timothy from Paul, there are weeks as a pastor that you'd rather just skip a passage. There are weeks that you're like, oh, that one doesn't look real fun. But in all honesty, I have enjoyed the preparation process. I've spent probably more time preparing for this passage than I have for any in a long time. But I've also enjoyed the research and learning and digging in and feeling the presence of the Holy Spirit kind of work through my own convictions and what I believe about what God is speaking to us through this passage. Now, as we've gone through the past 3 years, I really believe that misinformation could have been the word of the year for any of the past few. It's been in the news. It's been something we've all experienced. And sometimes there are true things that we're told are misinformation, and sometimes it's the opposite. It's just hard to know what to believe. And in 2023, in our secular world, we shouldn't be surprised that the idea of what our roles are, how men and women engage with one another, how we work together, we shouldn't be surprised that that's a little bit confusing, considering our secular world today can't even define what a woman is, let alone what responsibilities and rights are there. As we look at what it means for us to look at this important first century passage where Paul is instructing Timothy about orderly worship in the church, orderly corporate worship, it's not a surprise that it elicits a bit of a reaction, a negative reaction in us here in our modern time. There's a few things I think need to be prerequisites for us to really dig into this passage. And the first one is that our world today offers us a false choice, a false dichotomy between two things. It seems as though in our world today, it's either women rule the world and they're in charge, or women are oppressed by this tyrannical patriarchy. The women are either being heavily oppressed by men, or they have to be in the driver's seat and pushing the whole thing forward. And there is a wide range of options in between. As we look through the scriptures, as we understand what it is for a husband and wife to be married together, we see that there is a common theme of mutual submission. The word submission gets such a bad rap, but we have to remember that Jesus chooses to submit to the Father. The Holy Spirit chooses to submit to the Father, even though they are one. This mystery and paradox of the Trinity is hard for us to understand. One is not power to lord over the other, but together they mutually submit to one another. And Jesus' prayer for us is that we would be able to have a taste of how beautiful and how sweet it is to choose, to trust, to submit in the way that the Godhead, the Son, and the Spirit submit to one another. It's not a bad thing. Jesus says, this is my hope and prayer, is that you will experience what we experience in the Trinity. And God designs marriage and family and the church ministry together to be places in which we practice and we exercise this concept of mutual submission. So when the Bible speaks of submission, it's not talking about us lording power over another. It's not abusive and it's not meant to be negative. It's meant to be a way in which we have safety and we have trust to lean on each other, to lean into each other. Throughout history, men and women have been successful together because they have together submitted to one another to fight against a world that's difficult. Beth and I have been watching a little bit about the Oregon Trail. And for a long time, it was just a computer game that I lost on most of the time. Many of us, if you've played it or if your children played it, the text-based game in school, you barely ever made it with anyone intact. And You always would lose a family member along the way. It was difficult. And as I'm studying and kind of looking at what it was like to move west across the country, it was husbands and wives, and the role of men and women together was not one of a man lording over a woman. It was them versus the world, versus nature, versus all of everything that could come at them. Starvation and disease, rivers, wild animals. So God does not desire the relationship to be men, to be between men and women to be domineering or contentious. The second thing we have to understand is that Christianity has been a powerful force in elevating the way the world views women. But progress is a little bit like climbing a mountain. You can make so much progress and you can climb up over that mountain. There is a time and a place where you begin to climb down the backside of the mountain. And we live in an activist time where activists are acting. They have their QR code. They say, please send money. And there is a motivation to push narratives in our world today because it funds the coffers of whatever they're doing. I remember the first time that I saw the truth versus the messaging of an environmental group talking about deforestation. The truth was, in their area, there were more trees being planted and more work was being done to deal with deforestation in those jungles. But they couldn't tell you that, because then when you leave the zoo, you wouldn't throw a few dollars in the box. When we push too hard, there comes a point where we get to a balanced place, and then we begin to roll back down the hill. And I won't make the decision where we are when it comes to fighting for rights for women, because I have three daughters. I have a wife that I love. I want to see women have every opportunity and be able to thrive in the world. But God brings a little balance in our passage today that I believe, if we understand, will help us to have better marriages and more successful ministry together. And it begins with us looking at Paul's encouragement to celebrate inner beauty. Verse 9, I also want women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves not with elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds, appropriate for women who profess to worship God. Context here is really helpful for us. See, sometimes we read through the scriptures and we have the same kind of sparse, farm-like view in our mind of the landscape. It's either the desert or it's some small town. But Ephesus is neither of those. This is no Nazareth. Ephesus was a cosmopolitan place. It would be like a New York City, a Chicago, a Toronto, an L.A. This was one of the centers of the ancient world. There was commerce there, there was culture there, and there was religion there. In fact, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world resided in Ephesus, and it was the Temple of Artemis. And the Temple of Artemis was an interesting place. There was worship to the god Apollo, but it was centered around the priestess and the cult of Artemis. There were statues that are still visible today. You can see pictures or even go to a museum to see them. But it was this worship to Artemis. Now, unlike many other religions, this was worship in a very female-centric form. The temple, again, being one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, was massive, and people came from all over to worship there. There was a eunuch high priest that was a male, and the rest of the staff were recruited as virgins. They said there were up to 1,000 at any given time of these priestesses that served in the temple. And as I read through history, I don't know for certain. There had been a long historical belief that that temple prostitution was the biggest role for these virgins that came to serve in the temple, that was a big part of the cultic practices they had. But there are others who say no. So I don't know the answer to that, but what we do know is that looks were first and foremost one of the keys that was important for these women. They put on the best silk and the best jewels and the best gold, and they were making themselves beautiful, that they had to, at certain points, age out of the process too. They could be too old to serve. It was about having young, beautiful women serve in this religious cult. Appearance was important. And Paul is now starting a church. I mean, it's amazing to me. I've been in new church plants before, and it's messy. It's hard to put a church board together because you're all new converts. Maybe you're lucky there were a few people that came from a church down the street excited about what you were doing. But if God gives growth too fast and you find yourself with 300 people who 2 weeks ago weren't believers, it's amazing and God is glorified, but it's messy. You have all sorts of questions and challenges and things that you work through as 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago or a year ago, those couples who are now coming down to the altar and who are worshiping. This is true story from true churches I've been in. They were before that in sometimes same-sex relationships. Sometimes they were swinging couples that went out and shared each other with other couples on the weekends. It's a mess. They were alcoholics, they were into drugs, they had broken marriages. Everything the world has, when Christ moves in a community, there's conversion and God makes beautiful things from the ashes the world left behind. And now they're there in church. And there is no reason to believe and every reason to believe otherwise. There's no reason to believe that some of those converts who came into the Ephesian church weren't women that served as priestesses in the temple of Artemis. We know for certain that they were influenced by that culture. That men who were coming to worship may have worshipped in temple prostitution just 6 months or a year prior. And they're coming in and they're trying to relearn what is it to worship Jesus. And they have all this baggage. I remember I went to a church and they had taken, this was early in the modern music time, and they thought the thing to do was to take like hard rock songs that were from the world, like Metallica and, you know, all this other stuff that was out there, and they just gave it Christian words. And I'm not saying that that was a terrible thing, especially if you never listened to the old version of it. But as new people began to come into the church, they realized that there was baggage that many of them said, "Do you understand what the original words to that song are? Because I can't worship to it, because all I think about are the vile words that were once there. The violent words, the sexual words, whatever. I can't do that in church." And again, to the pure, all things are pure. Some people in the early church could eat meat that was sacrificed to idols because there was no power for the idol to them. But for new believers who are coming in, who are steeped in a history that's outside the church, some of this stuff is a hurt or a hang-up that keeps them from worship. And we have this beautiful, just kind of blend of people. There's those who grew up in the culture of Ephesus. There's those who most certainly served as priestesses in the temple of Artemis. There's those, and again, in Ephesus, it may have been a smaller amount than some of the other areas, but there was a Jewish synagogue there. There were Jewish people who had converted from Judaism to the new Christianity because they were following Jesus. And it was just the natural extension from where they were as Jewish believers before. And you have Jewish women who didn't learn, who learned modesty at a very young age, and then you have the women coming from the temple who are dressing to the nines, because that's what they understood you did when you went to the temple. And it's common when you hear criticism of this passage to see it blamed on men to say, well, this is just men trying to hold women back or not being able to control their thoughts. But in my experience in culture and church, the modesty question is often more driven by other women. Women can make each other feel very uncomfortable very quickly, either by dressing too provocatively or by not dressing provocatively enough. I think we have to understand that most of the modern beauty industry isn't really driven by men's desires. Because I could do a small straw poll of men I know about what it looks like for models who walk down the runway, and very few of them would find those women to be appealing. As skinny and emaciated, and I mean, it's not what men are looking for. And so Paul is saying to Timothy, he said, we've got to have some standards here, and we need to encourage the women coming in from all over the world, from all over our community, from all of these backgrounds, that the focus needs to be on inward beauty, not outward beauty. If you were somebody who hated people, let's call him the devil. I think one of the most effective things you could do to a marriage is convince men that the only thing that matters, the highest value, is physical beauty. Because in women, as we age, I think older women can be beautiful too. I'm not trying to say anything, but we have a problem in our culture where women in their 40s and 50s that haven't been married say it's really difficult because men their age tend to go for 20, 30-year-old women. If we elevate physical, external beauty to be the number one thing, it will leave men seeking younger and younger women over time, the old trading up for a younger model, and it will leave women feeling unsatisfied and unhappy and picky inside. It's a disaster waiting to happen, and it's what the enemy has done to our culture. I tell brides and grooms when I do a wedding, sometimes even in the message, but at least in person, I said, you need to remember that you will never look more beautiful or handsome likely than you do this day. Because there's very few occasions that we will put in the time and the effort to get as dressed up as we do the day that our wife walks down the aisle. From a physical beauty standpoint, if that is what we value, if that is what we invest in, then it will all be downhill from there. But if we as men learn to love the inner beauty of our wives, and our wives learn to cultivate that inner beauty, then they will become more and more beautiful to us every day. See, physical beauty, it wears off. I'm not nearly as handsome as I was 20 years ago. It's gone downhill fast. We all deal with age. But God asks us to cultivate that inward beauty. And He would say this to men, but men probably don't even understand the concept. Beauty is not something that we for ourselves struggle with nearly as much as women do. So he continues. And while I think it would be easy to read this and say, oh, Paul's being unfair to women or to misinterpret what he says, I really believe that what Paul is saying next is that we need to elevate our marriage. And I believe this message is just as true today as it was then. That the marriage is so essential to worship in the church. In verse 11, a woman, and there's something about the Greek here that I think we need to know. It can be translated woman, but it's often translated wife. It's by minimum a woman of marriageable age. Someone who's old enough to be married, who likely should be married or would be married, is the context of the word that's used here. So some translations will actually say a wife should learn in quietness and full submission. I, and this is Paul speaking about his own practice, I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. Again, we talked about the background here, but Jewish women are one of the groups that are coming in. And Jewish women, we have to remember, were not allowed in the inner court, or what they would call the court of Israel in the temple. So a quick geography, historical lesson here. The Jewish temple was a big complex, and it had a large building in the middle, and then it had outer gates that were part of it. And you had the holy place where sacrifice and only the priests were allowed. The most holy of holies was a part of that behind the curtain. Outward from that, you had the temple of Israel, but it really was the temple of men. Women weren't allowed there, and most of the teaching happened there. So if you were a Jewish woman, you didn't really learn much at church. You would hang out and talk to the other women, and there could be some education that would happen there. But the study of scriptures, if you're a woman, you weren't allowed to become a rabbi, you weren't allowed to study for that, happened in the temple of Israel, that inner temple. Outside of that, at the doorway to get into the temple of Israel, in fact, it wasn't really that private of a place for women because men were allowed to walk right through it, was the court of women. And then outside the court of women was the court that the Gentiles were allowed in. And this was outside the building. And this is that bizarre-like, carnival-like atmosphere where there are people selling doves and pigeons and animals for sacrifice. There's money being exchanged. There's the money changers taking your dramas and turning them into something else. All of that is happening, and that's the only place that if you are a believing Gentile, so if you are a Gentile like Cornelius who has decided to believe in the Jewish faith but hasn't made the decision to be circumcised yet, that's the furthest you're allowed in. This is the place where Jesus flipped the money changers' tables. There's lots going on. But there has been a dramatic change now in what women are allowed to do. In the Jewish church, women weren't allowed in the primary worship service. They were only allowed to come and fellowship. It'd be like saying, women, you can hang out in the chapel and have coffee and donuts, but you're not allowed in the sanctuary. That was the Jewish tradition. All of the primary worship for a Jewish person happened at home. The temple and the synagogue were important, but Jewish women learned the faith at home. Their husbands would bring what they learned in synagogue, at the temple, and they would bring that and share it with their wife and with their children. This was a part of the submission and the headship of the husband. This was part of how husbands would interact with their wives in ways that, even in this modern day, I think women deep down find fairly attractive. Women, when your husband takes an active role in spiritual things, when your husband in the midst of a crisis says, you know what, let's take a breath and I want to pray over my wife and my family, there is something very attractive about that to a wife. It's natural. It's built into us. And it doesn't mean that that husband has any authority that's negative, or it doesn't mean they're lording it over their wives. But when husbands step up, when they choose to lead in the home spiritually, it's appealing because God made us that way. In addition to Jewish women who weren't previously allowed to speak, and again, the worship service we're talking about in Ephesus wasn't like it is today. It wasn't as passive. And maybe this is something we should talk about in the future, but it was far more like Bible study than it would have been like what we're doing today. There was no microphone on Timothy or on Paul. We see pictures of it because we've seen in the book of Acts, there's the young man that's so bored that he falls out the window as they're just kind of sitting around a room. They're grouped in together. It's hot. It's stuffy. as they're all learning together. And you have the Jewish women who didn't have a context of being in the room before this moment. And then you have the women who served in the temple of Artemis, who I'm sure have questions and are trying to sort out the pagan practices they had from before with what Jesus is requiring of them today. And you had all others from that culture. I could only imagine what the room would be like if there wasn't a little bit of order. Have any of you ever been in a Bible study where one person just dominates the conversation with strange questions? And I'm not saying their questions aren't important, but there can come a line when one person's hand is always in the air. Maybe it's not even in the air, and they are just interrupting every other word. I've been in community groups and life groups and small groups and Bible studies where this has inevitably happened. And one of two things will happen next. You either begin to bring some order to it so everyone can have their needs and their questions met in that study, or you let it continue and you end up with three people. Or maybe just you and the person with their hand in the air. So there are some practical considerations here, as there's lots of questions. This is all brand new. This is new for everyone as they're trying to grow together. And I think it's important to understand that for Paul and his practice, and again, it's not a thus saith the Lord. Paul doesn't say Jesus commanded that women shouldn't speak in the church. That's not what he says here. He says, this is my practice. This is what I do. But it's not about devaluing women, especially because in leadership, we also see that Eunice, that Timothy's mother and grandmother, we see stories of Aquila and Priscilla and others that are foundational to the leadership of the early church. So it's not that women can't have some authority and some leadership, but it's this idea that Paul has that in marriage, it's very important for men to take the lead. So much so that I believe Paul is saying, and we'll get to it with the next verses, because that's where people get really confused. What in the world does this have to do with Adam and Eve? We'll get there. But I believe it is better in the context of a family and a marriage for a woman to be going a little bit slower in her faith if that's what it takes for the man in the relationship to be able to keep pace and maybe yet even lead. It's better to be able to bring that husband along, because what happens if the woman is sprinting and the man is being dragged behind, that relationship will be very frustrating, because God didn't design men and women to be like that. God created a desire in the heart of every wife to see their husband take a leadership role, to step up and to show the faith that he has, to be brave and courageous, not just in the world the way the world sees it, but as God calls it, to walk by faith, to say, Lord, here I am, send me, to plead and pray and to sacrifice for his family in the Lord. I have seen situations where women were ordained in ministry and they were pastoring churches and their husband had almost nothing to do with it. And I can tell you from experience and from conversations that it was frustrating. I'm not saying that it was right or wrong, because again, here Paul says, this is what I do. And I think there's some wisdom in it. But it's not about pushing women down. It's about the supremacy of the marriage relationship. There's a parallel example to this that we actually worked through a little bit here a long time ago. We got a curriculum for children's ministry called Faith Begins at Home. And this was really popular, where a lot of people were bussing kids in, and it became very controversial around. We even had to wrestle with it a little bit, because one of the programs they did was outside of Sunday morning. It was at a different time, and it was once a month. And for that program, they were encouraging how faith was taught at home, and it was more a lesson to the parents while the children watched about how to do this, about how to lead in their home with their children, how to lead morning Bible studies. And there was materials that went along with it, all sorts of great stuff. But there were people that were mad because there was a requirement on that meeting once a month. And that was, if mom and dad didn't come, kids couldn't come either. And I remember hearing people say, well, it's not fair to those kids who don't have Christian parents for them not to be able to come and have a good time too. For them not to be able to come in and engage. Why can't they do it? Well, because it was so important. And the side effects were so beneficial, not just to the families, but to the entire church, of what happens when mom and dad make it a priority to teach the faith not 1 hour on Sunday morning, but every single day with their families. That if we have to tell a few people who aren't prepared for that, that they can't come, so that we can focus on this priority, it was worth it, because the family unit is important. And we've worked a lot of ways around that. Over the past 50 years, we've taken the importance of the family and we've found ways to fund it without mom and dad. We've found ways to make sure that a lot of needs are met. And fair enough, you know, maybe the kids need the school lunch and they need the extra stuff. I'm not criticizing that. But at the end of the day, God designed the family unit to be something special. And just as the Father, just as the Son submits to the Father, and the Spirit submits to the Son and the Father, so in that marriage relationship, submission isn't a bad thing, but it's a pathway to deep connection and trust and intimacy. What Paul expected in these early believers, and we see other evidence of this, was that they would go home. And those questions would be answered by the husbands, and it gave an opportunity for the husbands to lead their wives, even if it was on training wheels, to take the next step. And finally, I think we have to understand this in the concept or the context of what comes next. If we look at chapter 3, if we look at chapter 4, Paul begins to give instruction to Timothy on what it is to be an elder or a deacon in the church. He makes it very clear that it is not a small thing for anyone to teach. It's a big deal, because if we teach something that's wrong in the name of Jesus, if we lead someone into sin in the name of Jesus, it has devastating consequences. Can you imagine how confusing it would be to a new convert in the church, whether male or female, if the confusion of one of those temple priestesses from Artemis were to come in and they would say, oh no, it's our sexuality, and it's by doing these bedroom things together that allow us to worship God. It would be confusing, and it may be appealing to the flesh. And finally, we'll go quickly here. For women, as you worship, it's important to appreciate your influence, because it's much stronger than you may realize. Verse 13, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. Paul hits this point in other places. And while it sounds like maybe Paul's giving women a hard time here, or he's being difficult for Eve, he's really not. What he's saying is Eve was actually deceived by the serpent. That Eve was lied to and believed it. That Eve's sin was that she believed something that wasn't true. When you compare it to what the Pauline theology of Adam is, it's much like that of Israel, in that Adam knew what he was doing was wrong, but he wanted to go along with his wife. So what's worse, to be sincerely deceived by something, or to say, okay, God, I'm going to be rebellious, I don't care, I like my wife, she's pretty, I'm going to do what she says? I think what Adam did was worse. He knew it was wrong. He knew it was wrong, but he said, you know what, I'm going to go along to get along. And this is what has been the downfall of Israel and maybe the marriage and the church for a long time. God told these Jewish men not to marry outside the faith, but they chose to. We see this in Solomon. We see this throughout history in the Jewish story, in Chronicles and Kings. These kings and these leaders would have wives that had pagan backgrounds. And as soon as it stopped raining on their fields, their wives would say, "Hey, I've got an idea. When I grew up, we worshiped these other gods, and we did it this way. And if we sacrifice a child to Molech, maybe it'll rain." And then they would. Even though they grew up steeped in the Jewish faith, they would say, "Okay, I'll do that because you're pretty and it'll make you happy." Men have a weakness for this. I had a friend who had a youth ministry, and he was talking about how he's like, "I don't know what to do." And it was the summer time when he talked to me about this. He said, "For some reason, all I have are teenage girls in the youth ministry." And he's like, I need more women to help out. And I said, "That's a true thing. You definitely need that." And had, we talked about how careful he needed to be because it was him and a bunch of teenage girls. And there was a lot that needed to, you know, keep things proper. But he's like, "I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to attract any boys to come to this youth ministry." And it had been growing very quickly. And I said, "Well, hold up." I said, "You have what, 12, 13 teenage girls? Wait till school starts and boys will be there." And sure enough, it was true. If you have a youth ministry with 13 pretty girls, boys will come and they will follow and they will say whatever they need to say and believe whatever they need to believe because there's girls there. This was Adam's problem. This is our problem today. And this is what Paul warns about. He said, when husband and wife are together, it's really hard for them to be deceived if they both are seeking the Lord well. But if the wife takes the leadership role and she says or believes something that isn't true, and there was plenty of that going around Ephesus, if the husband hasn't taken a leadership role, if the other things in this passage haven't taken place, then it's really easy for the man to say, whatever, I'll go with it. It's not what God wants. It's not what He's designed. So I don't believe for a moment this passage is a proof that Paul hated women. I don't believe for a moment that it's about putting women down. But today, if we are going to be a successful church, we need to encourage both men and women to grow in their faith together. And we need to do whatever we can to help the husbands in our church to take that role, because I believe deep down inside, wives, that's what you want. And if that means we need to do more men's Bible study, I'm for it. I'll help. I'll go. I'll make breakfast for the guys if that's what it takes. I'll buy donuts for us to study together, so that they can begin to take that leadership role in the home. Because I know in 2023, the statistics are very clear. We're doing this really poorly. Some men come and lead their homes, but the majority throughout the church in America today are being drug along by their wives. It's the wives who say, "We're going to the church," and the men say, "Okay." But if we're going to be successful, we need to see men in the church, husbands in the church, take a step up and say, "I'm going to lead my family and I'm going to lead my church." Not because women can't do it, but because when men do it, women do it too. When men lead, you don't lose a woman as a leader. You end up with both. Because I have to grow as fast as Beth does. And we're both then leaders. That's what God's calling us to, I believe. Let's continue to worship together.